All right, and welcome back. It is our number two of Hardline here on News Radio 930 WBEN. And, you know, there's always a lot to talk about when it comes to D.C. politics, but I just feel there's even more than usual. And to break it all down, we do have Buffalo's own editor-in-chief at Raw Story, Dave Leventhal. Dave, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Good to be with you.
Oh, great to have you here. And before we get into the politics, we just spent an hour talking about the NFT rail expansion. It's back in the news. I feel this is something that's been in the news for, you know, the last 20 years, but it's back in the news. We had someone who supports it and someone who is against the current proposal to bring the Metro Rail from South Campus to UB North Campus. Dave, you have an interesting perspective. You're from Buffalo, now living in the D.C. area. Looking at Buffalo the way it is in 2023, what, in your opinion, would a rail expansion mean, and do you think it's the right step for a city like Buffalo?
Yeah, so, you know, I grew up in the area when Metro Rail was being built and when it opened in the mid-'80s. So it's definitely something I used when I was living in Buffalo. Even when I come back, like, if I'm going to go to a Sabres game, I will take it. I like it. And, you know, living in D.C. where we have a massive, expansive rail system that, you know, involves now five lines, soon to be six, commuter rail, the whole nine yards. It really, you know, has transformed the city in a massive way from effectively having no Metro Rail to a system that has upwards of 200 different stations. So there are obviously pros and cons to any type of rail system without question. And the COVID experience has changed the way that people commute and their travel habits and whatnot. Just personally speaking, I mean, it's something that I think there could be a great deal of benefit from, especially along, you know, the rail extension. Economic development is a real thing, but there are obviously costs too. So, you know, I'm not trying to have it both ways here, but there are pros and cons, and that's what Buffalo and the Western New York area is going to be grappling with to see if truly this is going to be something that's worth it. And also, too, if a rail expansion is going to lead to good things for the city that just go beyond transportation, but also deal with economics, which is a huge component of this and often one that is not overlooked, but is downplayed relative to the core transportation factor, Joe.
You know, I think it's so interesting how people, you know, talk here in Buffalo about the Metro Rail. Like, I had the same experience as you. I've always taken the Metro Rail, but I also grew up right down the street from the South Campus station. So anytime my parents took us to an event downtown, we got on the Metro. Now, I realize most people don't live on the rail, right? I mean, it only goes to specific. I was lucky. I grew up by the rail. I went to college on the rail line. So I took the Metro Rail into my 20s because I lived on the rail line. It is interesting for people who never lived close to the rail line. You know, they never took it. Maybe if it ran by their house, it would change their perspective.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously for somebody listening in East Aurora or Lackawanna or somewhere where this is just not going to affect them, then they're probably going to come to a slightly different conclusion than somebody who, like you or like me, I grew up right off Kemmerer Avenue, and, you know, it was convenient. You could get there. You could almost walk there or take a bus or take a quick car ride. So there was the convenience factor that right now is obviously limited to the current, what, seven roughly mile line that exists. Well, if you're talking about many more miles that are added to it, that's going to be a whole new bevy of people who suddenly, you know, have the option to take it, and that's a consideration as well.
And maybe, Dave, in the next 35 years, it'll go out to the stadium. But, you know, let's take it one step at a time.
Or Niagara Falls, you know, great rail history in Buffalo where that used to be a thing, you know, about 100 years ago.
Dave, now focused on D.C., and like I said, a lot to talk about. And the story that just won't go away, you know, I Googled it on Google, obviously. And within the last 24 hours, numerous articles have popped up about this cocaine substance, this residue. I'm not sure exactly how much was found or what of it was found in the White House. Now the reports are that the story is a little different than initially reported, that it wasn't found where the White House first said it was. Where are we on Cocaine Gate?
Well, you know, the whole situation is a little overblown, no pun intended. But, you know, look, it is serious. Yes. Is it a problem? Of course, if you're finding illegal drugs in the White House, that is very newsworthy. At the same time, too, there have been many reports and speculation that this is Hunter Biden or Joe Biden's a cokehead. No, you know, the first family wasn't even in the White House when this was found. And look, lots of people go through the White House. There are tourists who go through the White House. There are many staffers, too. So somebody definitely screwed up. There's going to be a very thorough investigation that is already underway. But this is not something that I think is posing some sort of, let's say, existential threat to the Biden administration or Joe Biden or the White House executive office. And I would suspect that this is going to fade from the headlines relatively quickly, and we'll get a report in a couple of months or half a year or whatnot that will bring this all to a conclusion. I mean, yes, there is the possibility that there is some greater truth here to be discovered, but it may just be somebody was bringing some illegal drugs in a dime bag into the White House, and it dropped out of their pocket, and, you know, they happened to be a tourist from Nebraska. We don't know yet, and we're going to find out at some point.
And they wouldn't let me on my tour in 2009 walk in with a SpongeBob popsicle.
Well, in a way, that's just as disturbing, but I'll leave that to you.
Well, you know, the nose was bubblegum, Dave, and they did let me have the bubblegum before I had to throw it out. Speaking of the Biden White House this week, it seems like the focus now, you know, heading into 2024 is Bidenomics, talking about the jobs numbers, talking about the economy. The Biden economy seems to be the big pushing point. And Dave, is it the pushing point that the Biden administration thinks that it is?
Well, first of all, the Biden administration thinks that it is, and that's why they're running on this and making this as big a priority, and even going so far as to name it and push that name in the way that they have. So expect Joe Biden during the campaign on the trail, but also in his official current capacity as president of the United States, to hammer this issue every which way that they possibly can. This is going to be the issue that Joe Biden runs on. It's going to be the economy stupid. It's the economy stupid all over again, a la Bill Clinton in 1992. And the Biden administration thinks that this is a winning issue for the country. The Biden campaign thinks it's going to be the winning issue for them in the presidential race. Now, a lot can change, as we well know, and what is true about the economy today could be wildly different if we're having this conversation a year from now or 2 weeks before Election Day. So it's tenuous, and if things suddenly go south, or the country was to dive into a recession, or there's economic factors that we can't even begin to predict that come to the foray and become reality at some time in the relatively near future, then, you know, Bidenomics is probably not going to hold as much water as it does right now. But at least in the current situation, Joe, the numbers are going relatively in the right direction. There are still so many people feeling great pain around this country, too. So the economy is a mixed bag. It's been great for some, and in the past year, relative to where it was during the depths of the pandemic. And it's still, you know, incredibly, for millions of people all around the country, something where they're scratching their heads saying, yeah, the economy is not looking so great for me right now.
Speaking of the economy, I've noticed this week members of Congress starting to talk about Social Security on social media again. Is Social Security back in the news? Is there a proposed bill to cut Social Security? We hear this every now and then that the GOP is trying to take your Social Security away, or, you know, the Democrats are trying to, you know, it's always the other party trying to take your Social Security away. Is there any truth to that? Is there a reason that it's back on a lot of members of Congress Twitter pages?
So two things to know about this. Number one, what you're hearing in the moment, it's all talk. There's nothing that's going to change materially in any significant way about Social Security in the next many months. We have divided government. We have Republicans in the House taking the House and running the House. We have Democrats in the Senate. Joe Biden, of course, is president of the United States. So the notion of any real bill that's going to drastically change Social Security anytime in the next year and a half, forget about it. But the problem is real, and Social Security, particularly the trust fund for Social Security, it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It's going to run out of money unless Congress and the federal government does something at some point. So one of the things that Republicans are offering up at this point in sort of a framework for changes to Social Security is raising the retirement age for Social Security, bringing it up to, say, 2 years above where it is right now. And people, when you look at the curves, are living longer than they used to 30, 40, 50 years ago. And there's a problem that we have in the country, Joe, which is that there are many people who are retiring and not enough workers coming behind them to pay into the system to keep it solvent. So this is a very emotional issue, but it's also just a hardcore math issue. And if the numbers don't add up, well, Social Security is going to have a problem, and we can see that coming down the pipe.
Now, we also got some news. I believe on Friday we got the news that the administration will be sending more help to Ukraine. When we say help, what do we mean, Dave?
Well, we mean cluster bombs, and without getting into the technical specifics and specifications of what they are, these are a type of munition that are incredibly deadly, oftentimes will linger for years or even decades after a war. They're basically little bomblets that can be distributed over a large area. And many countries all around the world have said that is a weapon that we want to ban, and that they have banned. The United States, notably, has not signed onto treaties that are involved with this. Neither has Russia or Ukraine. So, in a way, you've got Russia using them now. You've got Ukraine already using them, but running out, and the United States saying, "Well, hey, we've got some too, and we're going to use it." Very controversial decision for Joe Biden to go ahead and authorize the use of the transfer. Of these types of munitions to Ukraine so that they can be used there. And even very close allies such as Canada have been quite critical, pointedly critical, about the United States' decision to do this. And many Democrats, especially those on the far left, have been critical of Joe Biden's decision to do this too, even though they're all within the same party. So this is not something that is likely going to be tamped down anytime soon. This is a big decision for Joe Biden. He made a call, and we're going to see how this goes. It may not go well.
Yeah, talking about the support for the U.S. helping Ukraine, it seems to be all over the map, Dave. You've got people on the right who oppose, especially the financial help, the U.S., to the extent the U.S. has given Ukraine. And you also see that some on the left as well. I mean, Lindsey Graham, of all people, is applauding the president's decision to send those things to Ukraine. Where is this? Is this not by party? Is this really by person?
I think, Joe, it reveals some of the schisms that do exist within both the major parties in the United States. You still have some more traditional, almost Reagan-era war hawks in the Republican Party who are delighted to see that the United States is continuing to support Ukraine militarily in the fashion that it is. You have other Republicans who are saying, no, this is crazy, and that we should not be helping Ukraine any more than we have, and are looking at sort of the financial aspects of this. Some on the very, very far right who are skeptical about the United States' involvement in this conflict altogether. And then you have on the Democratic side kind of the same deal. You have a lot of very far left progressive wing Democrats saying that, no, you know, we should not be involved in this war any more than we have to. And this is a folly, and this can't go on forever. And other Democrats like Joe Biden who are more moderate. So in essence, you kind of have the most moderate Republicans and most moderate Democrats finding some degree of rare commonality over this issue, and it does show again that and underscore the idea that not all the time are the Democratic Party and the Republican Party just monoliths here, not monochromatic in their blue and their red, that there are disagreements and material ones that in this particular case matter quite a bit.
You know, to go back to Lindsey Graham, because I went to his Twitter page to make sure that what I was saying was accurate. He's also trying to get Senate to pass a resolution urging the admission of Ukraine into NATO. From what you're hearing, is that support in Washington?
Not enough, and not enough in NATO, too. And the problem there is very simple, that if Ukraine was allowed to come into NATO, then there's this thing called Article 5. And you might remember that from going back 20 years when I think it was the only time that Article 5 has actually been used when the September 11th attack happened. And basically it says that if one country in NATO gets attacked, then the others will come to its military aid at the degree that it needs to. So the notion of Ukraine coming into NATO and then every NATO country from the United States to Great Britain to France to Poland and so on getting involved militarily against Russia is an absolute complete non-starter. Now, we are getting involved militarily in the sense of providing aid to Ukraine, but of course they're not getting involved militarily in terms of putting U.S. soldier boots on the ground or for any other NATO country for that matter.
You know, Dave, it's the story that kind of goes away for a few news cycles and then comes back. I'm finding with Ukraine, right? For the last year, it's kind of, all right, we're not hearing much about it, and then we hear tons about it for like a few weeks. Are you noticing the same thing?
Yeah, and, you know, oftentimes that's news habits, reader habits, listener habits, and, you know, sometimes the war will ebb and flow in terms of what is exactly happening. The offensive that Ukraine has been waging over the past many weeks, it is not stalled, but it's running into difficulty from all accounts. So that's been something that has been very difficult for the United States, and that they obviously want the Ukraine advancement to advance, and it's not. So the munition discussion and the cluster bomb discussion is very much been tied to that particular element of the conflict. And when the United States makes a big decision, well, you know, all news is local, right? So the things that are happening in the United States relative to the conflict in Ukraine and vis-a-vis the conflict in Ukraine, that's the things that oftentimes are going to make news. And that's exactly what we saw in this situation, Jeff.
Dave, over at Raw Story, you guys broke the story of a Democratic senator who has broken the Stock Act three times since 2022. I feel like you and I always go back to this, members of D.C., I guess I should say, but of Senate and Congress keep on breaking the Stock Act. What is the Stock Act, and who is the senator that the newest senator to join the list?
Well, the 10-second Stock Act explanation is the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. It was a law passed in 2012, and basically it was put forward to stop conflicts of interest and curb insider trading and provide transparency for members of Congress who trade stocks and cryptocurrency and other types of financial instruments. But the problem is, and we found out with loads of information here that we've reported throughout the year, that many members of Congress just break this law, and there are very few consequences for it. So the latest senator that we've caught doing it is one who's done it before. In fact, two times before over the past 14 months, and it's Senator Tom Carper from Delaware. He is a Democrat. He's retiring at the end of this current term, so he'll be out in 2025. But every time we've asked him about this, his office says, "Oh, it was a clerical error." Well, you know, that's sort of a dog ate my homework kind of excuse here. And the problem is that you have members of Congress and dozens of them too that are actively trading stocks and bonds and other types of financial instruments at the same time when they're making big decisions in Congress that personally could financially affect them. So if you've got, say, for example, $1 million worth of a defense contractor stock and you're making a vote or making decisions or promoting a policy that would directly affect the financial fortunes of defense contractors, then a lot of people would consider that to be a conflict of interest, a financial conflict of interest. And if you're not disclosing what you're doing in a timely fashion, which the law spells out very clearly, then, you know, ostensibly that's a problem. Democrats do this. Republicans do this. I know everyone's like, oh, false equivalency. Well, no, this is the opposite of false equivalency. There is true equivalency here. And we've been reporting on this chapter and verse. So definitely check it out.
Is it always an error when they get called on it? Or does anyone ever admit, yeah, I screwed up?
Yeah, a lot of them do, and they're not going to admit it voluntarily, but there is a paper trail, or oftentimes a lack of paper trail, and we can see that. We keep track of it literally every day at Raw Story. And when we catch somebody doing something that is against the letter, spirit, or both of the law, then we ask them about it. We've got reporters on Capitol Hill and make lots of calls and try to get to the bottom of things. And when we find somebody who has violated this law, I mean, this is a law that Congress passed for itself. So if they can't follow this law, what, you know, we have, I think, firm ground to question, you know, what they're doing, particularly when it comes to the lawmaking process. So that's one of the big reasons why we're interested in this.
On your Twitter page, 2 days ago, you mentioned that Chris Christie and Donald Trump have asked for additional time to reveal details about their personal finances. Is this common? And did former President Trump do this the last time he ran?
Yeah, it's increasingly common. And this is sort of a kissing cousin to the situation that we just talked about with the Stock Act. If you're a presidential candidate, you, by law, have to disclose every year your personal finances, things that you have bought and sold and assets that you have, any debts that you might have, royalties that you've received, etc. And Donald Trump has kicked the can down the road now twice. He did this before because he had to file some other things since he ran for president or started running for president again in 2024 back in November. And he revealed some information back a few months ago, but he has to reveal more now, and he's asked for a couple of extensions. Chris Christie has done the same thing. Ron DeSantis did the same thing. So you've got a lot of candidates who are just picking the extent of what the law says that they can do. They're not doing anything illegal, but they're not being as transparent as they can. This used to be something where it was almost a point of pride for presidential candidates, or presidents for that matter, to say, hey, I'm being transparent and upfront and on the deadline. I didn't ask for an extension. I did it right away. Now, Donald Trump did that when he was president of the United States, but is not doing it now. Now, of course, things have changed for Donald Trump, and he's obviously in a very different legal situation than he was when he was president of the United States. Now, whether that has whether that factors into it directly, we don't know, and he's not commenting on it. But we've seen a number of Republican presidential candidates do this. Joe Biden got his on time, but not to say that he will absolutely, you know, in the future. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, he also asked for an extension as well. So, you know, we've got a mixed bag here.
Looking at that 2024 field, I was watching Smirconish because it was on at the gym yesterday, and they had someone from Predict It, and these are the people that put like the 54 cents. I don't really understand that, but right. Looking at it now, still it seems that Donald Trump, now that DeSantis is in the race, this tells you how much I know politics. I said once DeSantis is in it, we'll get closer. There's no evidence of that yet, Dave. What is the thought in D.C. amongst Republicans looking at this primary field?
Well, Donald Trump is the leader, hands down, and he will likely be the leader for the foreseeable future. There's nothing that any of the other Republican candidates have done to this point to unseat Donald Trump from that position. Now, again, lots can happen, and we've got a ton of time here. We're going to have debates, and we're going to see the candidates go toe-to-toe with each other. Donald Trump may or may not participate in them, which will be curious. Ron DeSantis has said that he will. So that's going to be one opportunity and an inflection point. And obviously, we have so many things that are going to be happening on the legal front with Donald Trump. He's been indicted in two different jurisdictions. He has pending charges against him in New York and at the federal level. There could be more coming very soon in the state of Georgia, and more yet at the federal level. So all of that is going to be really on its own track. And these are things that Donald Trump cannot control. These are things that Donald Trump is going to have to face up to. And it's all going to be happening simultaneous with the presidential election on a schedule that has not been determined yet. So these are huge, huge variables that are truly unprecedented in U.S. presidential election history. And, you know, if you do look at that history, too, oftentimes the complexion of a race, whether it's a on the D side or the R side, things can change very dramatically as voter tastes change, as voters hear from the different candidates. I mean, Hillary Clinton was absolutely kicking Barack Obama's tail at this point in the election in 2008, and, well, who became president of the United States? And think about Jeb Bush back in 2016 and what happened to him. I mean, he was the top of the heap and then fell all the way to the bottom over the course of about 6 months. So, you know, just two examples of a litany that we could discuss, but these things are not fixed. They are not in the political firmament. What's happening in July of 2023 is almost certainly going to be a lot different than what's going to be happening in, say, February of 2024.
I do find it weird, and I know you and I have had this conversation, but I do find it weird that you've got all these people still getting into the GOP field, names you've heard of, names that, you know, I have to text Dave and say, who is this? And they're all running as, hey, we have Trump's policy without Trump's personality. I mean, it seems like every candidate is trying to be Trump without being Trump. So they're just mixing or, you know, dividing the person that wants the Republican who wants the Trump policy without the Trump personality. Seems like it's a losing strategy and going to be the way Trump gets to a nomination. Is this what Republicans are saying in D.C.?
Well, it seems like a losing strategy at this moment, and so far it is. The polls play that out. I mean, none of them are vaulting to the top or overtaking Donald Trump. So, well, you know, he's faced with somebody who's got Trump policies but isn't Donald Trump, and then also having the option of Donald Trump and Donald Trump's policies, people who supported Donald Trump and who have been supporting Donald Trump are going to pick Donald Trump. I mean, it's human nature and it's just political reality, basic 101. And so, but they're all hoping for two things. Number one, they have in this situation an opportunity to get their name out there, to boost kind of their own political brand. This is very self-serving, but you know, these candidates who are getting in, you know, Bob Burgum and Vivek Ramaswamy and some of them who are pulling at 1 or 2%, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Mike Pence even, they have very little to lose here by getting into the race. It's not like their name is going to be tarnished or tarnished any more than it already has been. And here's the other thing, too. They're all hoping that Donald Trump is going to implode, that somehow, some way, at some point in time, he's going to you know, be put into a jail, or he is going to be convicted of something. Donald Trump is also, you know, he's in his going into his late 70s. He could have a health problem. I mean, a lot can happen, and maybe none of this does, but maybe something does. And if something does, either you're in the arena or you're not in the arena, and they want to make sure that they're in the arena, which is why we see so many candidates so willing to get in at this point.
Now, we've had more people jump into this GOP field, Dave, as you talked about. And one person, I mean, I've never heard of either of them. One is Corey Stapleton, and he blocked you on Twitter.
He did. He apparently didn't like the fact that I posted his public, I should note, personal financial disclosure on Twitter when we obtained it from the Federal Election Commission, and responded without any words, but by blocking me on Twitter. Well, his choice to make, but we will post public documents for any and all of these candidates, Republican or Democrat. So good for him.
And another one that I did not know was in the field until you sent me this article this morning, John Anthony Castro, and you guys actually did a story on him at Raw Story. What's that about?
Yeah, I spoke to him a little while back and interviewed him, and I was as curious as anyone because I had saw that or seen that he had loaned his campaign $20 million. Now, John Anthony Castro, I mean, I'll give you a dollar if you've actually heard of him. I mean, he's a Republican presidential candidate, has been running for at least ostensibly on paper for months now. But he's somebody who is very, very anti-Trump. So he's one of the few candidates in the race who is like, no, I am 100% against Donald Trump. And you could put him maybe with Chris Christie and a couple of others, but that's about it. And basically his plan, as we reported, is that he's going to New Hampshire. He's going to try to go directly at Donald Trump. He has a plan that he was a little cagey about, but in essence says that he really is going to make this about the president. Now, he has about as much, you know, chance of winning the Republican presidential nomination as the Sabres have winning the Super Bowl. But, you know, let's put it in real terms. He could use that $20 million to make life a little bit more complicated for Donald Trump. And that's what he's trying to do, not only in the political race, but also he has some legal action that's pending against Donald Trump, trying to get him out of the presidential race, using a very novel argument about the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, saying that insurrectionists are ineligible to run for public office. So seems to be a real agitator, maybe even a gadfly, but one who has done great in business, is a tax attorney in Texas, and is willing to put some of his own money behind this effort to make Donald Trump's life, again, a little bit more difficult.
Now, on the Democratic side, obviously, incumbent Joe Biden is the favorite by far to be the nominee going into 2024. But RFK Jr. has really been making the rounds. He was on News Nation a week ago. He was on the Bill Maher podcast. I mean, it seems that RFK is really into running a campaign and trying everything he can to get Joe Biden to do a debate.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we can debate for more time than we have here about his motivations behind doing this, why he wants to do this. I think in many election years, he would be poo-pooed and just truly to the fringes. But it does speak to the fact that there are many Democrats who are going to support Joe Biden, but are like, oh, Joe Biden's going to be 86 years old at the end of his second term, were he to win again. Do we really want that? There are some Democrats who are disaffected by Joe Biden. There are some independents who are not thrilled about any of the prospects of any of the candidates running. They're kind of looking to somebody like an RFK Jr. Now, I mean, let's be real about this. RFK Jr., why is he getting the attention that he's getting? Well, he has a certain last name. And it's very difficult to just dismiss a Kennedy, no matter how fringy they may be or how their ideas are out of the mainstream. But there's also some ideas that he has that are very popular, especially when it deals with health issues, environmental issues, definitely vaccines, which is one of his big one that people are attracted to. It may not be the majority of the population, but it is a vocal minority. And at least at this point, that's enough to definitely get some attention for your campaign. Now, he may yet completely flame out. There's almost certainly going to be no scenario where he beats Joe Biden, but he definitely could. He's revealing a weakness in Joe Biden right now, whether that matters at all in some sort of political sense remains to be seen, but likely not. But still, Joe Biden probably, if he had the choice, he wouldn't want RFK Jr. in the race and would like to have a coronation for his Republican or for his Democratic nomination and let the Republicans slog it out while they have multiple candidates on their side.
Dave, I know I'm going over our allotted time, but I've got just a few more questions, because you talk about how, you know, the independents, the last thing they want is Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. I think most Americans, and this is what, again, this is what surprises me. I'd like your take on it. Most Americans do not want a rematch of 2020. I mean, any poll that's taken on this, they do not want to see these two men run against each other. Yet, when you go party by party, majority of the Democrats want Joe Biden to run. A majority of Republicans want Donald Trump to run. And I'm sitting here saying, I thought the point was getting independents and no one's listening to them.
Yeah, well, you know, unless independents put up their own candidate, this is what we've got in this situation. So this does raise the issue of, will there be some sort of third party or independent presidential candidate to emerge? More or less, you got to be a Democrat to support the Democratic candidate in the context of the nominating process. You got to be a Republican to support the Republican candidate in the Republican nominating process. And the independents are kind of left to watch and listen and learn and lament until the general election comes around, when they have a choice between one or two. So is there going to be some sort of, you know, Ross Perot 2.0 for 2024? I don't know. You know, we'll see what happens. At least at this point, that does not seem to be a thing, and we still have some time left. But the way our system is set up, Democrats are kind of handcuffed. Joe Biden decided to run. So what are you going to do? Try to kick the current president out of the presidential nominating process? That's a total non-starter. And on the Republican side, I mean, Donald Trump has the most support of any Republican presidential candidate, bar none, hands down. So until that dynamic changes, as we talked about, if it ever does, Donald Trump is going to be at the top of the heap, even if lots of people are saying, oh, you know, the worst thing that could happen would be a Trump-Biden rematch and they want something different. Well, enough people kind of don't want something different, or at least don't want half of that equation to change. And you add it all up, and it's looking Biden and Trump again. But very quickly, I'm not convinced that Joe Biden and Donald Trump will happen in 2024, because there are so many variables and factors, and agent help does factor into this. This is something that we're all going to have to pay attention to. And then obviously the legal situation for Donald Trump is also, just casting a cloud over his presidential campaign in a way that is indeed very unpredictable.
If Joe Biden were to not run, I'm looking at the odds right now. The second place is Gavin Newsom. Is that a popular name amongst Democrats to eventually run for the White House?
I mean, popular enough to play some parlor games with it. The governor of California, he definitely, I think, given the opportunity to run for president, would jump at it. But we have somebody else in the equation here, and that is Vice President Kamala Harris, who is not very popular. In fact, in many polls, is polling as more unpopular than Joe Biden, who's not polling great these days, but well enough to certainly be the nominee. So there could be some definite drama. Pete Buttigieg is always the transportation secretary and 2020 candidate, is always discussed in the mix for these types of conversations. But, really, this is all theoretical and completely, not real until something changes with Joe Biden. And if nothing changes with Joe Biden, well, Joe Biden's the guy.
Well, I'll tell you this. Gavin Newsom and Sean Hannity sat down and had like a two-episode conversation. I'd like to see more of that. I don't know if there's any appetite for that in D.C., but I'd love to see people that are the face of two different sides of the aisle have a conversation, have disagreements, but have a conversation. I'd like to see more of that in D.C., Dave. If you can get that message out there, Joe Beamer says more friendly-ish conversations between the opposing parties.
I'll pass the word. But, we mentioned Pete Buttigieg. He's somebody who's been very willing to go on Fox News and kind of cross over to the news station that would be unexpected to a lot of people. But, and that does happen at least to some degree on the Republican side, too. Trying to get people out of their echo chambers is a real thing, and also appeal to at least some small percentage of the opposite party. So even if they don't like you and are not thrilled with you and don't like your ideas, well, maybe they'll learn something as sort of the idea. But you've seized on something. It's happening a little bit more than we would have seen it, maybe not that long ago.
Last question, I promise. You spoke about echo chambers. Threads made its appearance this week. How is Threads going over in the Capitol?
It's going over well enough for if you're Mark Zuckerberg and Meta and Facebook. I mean, there have been tens and tens of millions of people, upwards of almost 100 million, and we may surpass that number pretty soon here, that have signed up. I mean, it's not that hard of an ask, because so many people are on Facebook and or Instagram, which are owned by Meta and are all part of the Facebook family. So this is all very much in response to the conflagration that's happening over at Twitter and creating sort of these crazy cross currents in social media world. Now, is this going to be something that ultimately is sustainable or that people like? I mean, a lot of people have joined but have been critical about the functionality. Threads has said that it really doesn't want to focus on news and politics. So that's going to be an interesting element, too. And Twitter, of course, is still there, and many, many people are still on it. So I don't know. We may have a few listeners pining for the days of, MySpace and Google Plus, and there are definitely other alternatives out there. There's Mastodon and Blue Sky and a few others, but it definitely seems to be the Elon Musk versus Mark Zuckerberg billionaire punch out right now through the proxy of social media. And I guess we're all along for the ride, or the tweet, or the thread, or whatever it is.
Dave Leventhal, editor-in-chief at Raw Story. Dave, I went 20 minutes longer than I said with you. I appreciate all the great content.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joe.